All right, the book of Daniel, chapter 3, is what we are going to cover today. This is a story that is familiar, I think, to many of us. It is Daniel, well, it's in the book of Daniel, although Daniel is absent from this story. But three other guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, become the focus, and the fiery furnace is here for us. And this is a great flannel graph story. Right, you have the little flames against the black drops, and you kind of move the guys in, you drop them in the fire, and then there's a fourth figure, and you take them out. This story has been helpful to God's people for a long time. In the fourth century, so just early centuries of the church, they found tombs, sarcophagi, with this story emblazoned on it. They sort of carved it in. And it's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in flames. And it's an interesting picture. And the hope that people found in this story and the hope that we can find in this story is that God saves his people, even from fire. That's often how people have seen this. And so we read it. We say this is a great story. I hope as we go slowly through it together this morning, we will also see just how complicated it is. How difficult the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is, and we'll kind of together put ourselves in the story at certain points and say, what would we have done? That's one of the things we'll do. Because it's easy to sort of read it and say, if you just have great faith, things will go well for you. And in a sense, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do have great faith, and it goes well for them. And the question then we ask is, well, what if it doesn't? What if I have great faith like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the fire still burns me, right? That's a question we will ask. As we get in, a few things to note about it. This book really fits the big themes, or this chapter fits the big themes we've seen in the book of Daniel so far, of God's sovereignty. God is in control of all things. God's people are in exile, and they need to live faithfully. So some of the big themes that we'll see again in this passage. One thing to just pay attention to as we read it together is pay attention to the things that are repeated. Especially in a Hebrew narrative like this, the things that are repeated are significant. And so as you read it, sometimes it'll feel like a little wordy because we're reading a whole list of people's names again, or there's one phrase, one verb, set up. Pay attention to that. That's going to come up a bunch of times, even in these first seven verses. And all of those things matter. Quick outline, and then we'll start reading. This passage begins with a decree of the king. It moves to a confession by the king, and then ends with another decree. And those decrees will be almost opposite to each other because of what God does in the midst of the story. All right, so let's read, starting in verse 1 together. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." All right. "Had set up" occurred, I think, like 7 or 8 times in that passage. We see Nebuchadnezzar setting up this image, and that's really the focus in this first part. The question is, what is this image, and why is he setting it up? We see back in verse 1, that it's 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. So in our measurements, that's 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. So it's a very tall, slender statue. And people debate about you know, what this was all made of. We know that it wouldn't have been solid gold, but it would have been a statue that was overlaid with gold, as was their custom. Some people will say maybe this was up on a pedestal that made it 90 feet tall, because to be proportional, if it's 9 feet wide, it can only be 35 feet tall. Otherwise, the human proportions are out of whack. People get into the details there. The point is, this is a significant statue that has been set up by the king. And the king has erected it here in this plain of Dura, so that people have to gather around it. The plain of Dura, it's probably a sort of suburb of Babylon. Maybe he was building it out there sort of as a surprise and bringing people out there, or maybe he's just sort of focused on this region. We don't know exactly. But think about this. We have this statue that's set up. Think back to the dream last week. What was the dream of?
A statue,
right? And remember, if you remember the statue, head of gold, that symbolizes Babylon, followed by silver, bronze, and then iron and clay. And so I think the fair way to read this and to take this is what King Nebuchadnezzar is doing is he's being reminded of that dream. And he's saying, what was the outcome of that dream? Well, I'm the head of gold. And then after me, other people come. They're not as glorious as me. And it gets down to this base that's really fragile and not very good. And so in a sense, what Nebuchadnezzar probably is doing here is he's sort of taking that dream that was a warning and saying, that's not going to happen to me. I'm going to be the head of gold, the chest of gold, the legs of gold, everything of gold, and my kingdom is never going to end. In fact, they have found a Babylonian document, an inscription from around this time. It may not have been Nebuchadnezzar himself who wrote this, but he said this in a document. Beside my statue as king, I wrote an inscription mentioning my name. I erected for posterity. May future kings respect the monument. Remember the praise of the gods. He who respects my royal name, who does not diminish my statutes and not change my decrees, his throne shall be secure. His life lasts long. His dynasty shall continue. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do. He's trying to say that dream that happened, that God interpreted, that sort of said all these things, I'm glad I know what it meant. I'm taking that as a warning. And now by my might and my power, I'm going to make sure that my kingdom lasts forever. That's kind of what he's getting at. And to do that, he sets up this statue, and then he calls all of these people that we saw the list a few times, right? Satraps. They had something called a satrapy, which is a province. So it's just somebody in charge of a province. All of the officials, and he gathers them all together. But one thing to note particularly in how he phrases this, where is it? It says that it's all the nations, the languages, the peoples in verse 4. That's what these people, these leaders represented. Remember how Babylon chose to rule its people was to sort of take the leaders that existed in that country, take them back to Babylon, train them as Babylonians, and then say, you go rule. Because you understand your people, your customs, those sorts of things, but you got to make sure that we're number one, and you pay us taxes, and you kind of worship our gods, and those sorts of things. And so in a sense, what's happening here is he's consolidating his power. It's come to the king, sort of kiss the signet ring of the king, and prove that you worship our God, our gods. That's his goal behind this. And so you see all the people, nations coming, and what do they all do? I mean, think about it. You get invited. You're a leader in the place. You get invited to Babylon to participate in this dedication ceremony, this ribbon cutting, to use our terms. You think there's going to be some good things, right? There's probably going to be a feast afterwards, a good after party. I'm willing to come. Like, it's Babylon, right? There's going to be the best graham crackers, right? It's going to be good. And so it makes sense that these people come, and they kind of are like, well, what's another god? What's another kind of act of worship? This guy has conquered us anyways. And so they hear this music and they participate in what they're asked to do. Now think about just the music for a moment. It's interesting, did you see bagpipes in the Bible?
Yeah.
Bagpipes are in the Bible. Went on YouTube to try to find a Babylonian bagpipe, and there wasn't a recording, but I went down the rabbit trail a little bit on this. Because the word here is actually a word from Greek. And so what Babylonians would do is they'd actually, when they took over a culture, they'd kind of borrow parts of their culture. So it could be a sort of this Greek instrument that they're they're using here. And literally what the instrument is they take a goat, and they take the goat skin, they stitch it up, and they put like a mouthpiece in one part of it, and out the other side like a reed thing. And it sounds about what you think that would sound like. Yeah, it sounds like a bleeding goat, I don't know. I don't know if you like bagpipe music or not. I love bagpipe music, but this one was particularly like, wow, that's just kind of like a noise. All that to say, there's all this cacophony of noise that it was actually probably beautiful and prepared, all these sorts of things. And when you hear it, that signals an action, right? You are to worship this image. You are to fall down and pay homage to this. And if you don't, by the way, there's this fiery furnace. If you don't do that, there's a furnace. And we'll talk more about the furnace and what that kind of specifically might have looked like in a moment. But, you know, this is what you're called to do. You're called to comply with this. You are now part of Babylon, and so behave as you would as a Babylonian. Behave as a Babylonian, and it'll go well for you. If you don't, well, sorry, we have a furnace for you. What do you do? Yeah, question.
Well, do you think that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were the only ones that didn't bow down? Because there were a whole bunch of other exiles there.
The short answer is we don't know. I don't think anybody else did. Because the text does sort of say, and they all bowed down. Verse 7, therefore, as soon as all the people heard, they worshiped the golden image. So it seemed like most people didn't have a real issue with this. And that is actually something, again, that's unique about the Jews, unique about God's people in this moment. Partially because, what does the first and second commandment say?
Yeah.
Right? You shall have no other gods before me, commandment 1. Commandment 2, you shall not make an image and worship it, commandment 2. And so they're unique in the sort of the gods of the day, the religions of the day in regards to that. And I think it's important to note that most of these people, they might have had their god, but they were okay with other gods, if that makes sense. Here's my god, my country's god, but the other person over there, their god's powerful too. It's a real god. They didn't have this view that there was only one god. That's unique to sort of Judaism and Israel at this point. They're a monotheistic religion in a way that other nations aren't. And so for the rest of them, they could really say, yeah, my God was conquered, right? My God got beat. So I'm going to go worship this new God. And it's arguable that even the Israel or the people of God's people in this day would have struggled with that a little bit. They would have been attracted to other gods. We can talk about that a little bit. They would have often thought that those gods were real, right? You don't go, like, you know, think about the Bible and the Old Testament when you see them sort of going and worshiping other gods. It wasn't like they just woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to go worship an idol. That seems like a good idea. No, the world that they lived in, they thought other gods were real. And it's also worth noting that even Babylonians, they didn't look at the image and say, that there is my god. They would say that represents my god. When they would build a statue, they'd have an elaborate ritual of sort of inviting the god to come and dwell in this statue. So they had a more sophisticated understanding than maybe sometimes we think they did, and also explains their understanding of that. But you have this moment now. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know that they can't do this. It's against the first and second commandment. And now what are they going to do? Or to phrase it another way, what are you going to do? You're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You have heard the king's summons. You've heard the music. You've shown up in Dura as you were supposed to do. What do you do? We know the right answer, right? We're like, I would have stood up boldly as everybody else is laying down. from the first class, my favorite comment was, I would have, like, just try to sleep in that day and not show up. Right? Like, you could have tried that, or you could have tried we don't know the whole picture. Are the sort of Chaldeans around there with clipboards, like, checking off people's names to make sure you bowed? Like, we don't know all of that. Would people, like, try to, like, just kind of, like, half bow and, like, you know, people would have rationalized a lot of different responses, just like we might have rationalized or rationalize a lot of different responses. What do you think? What would you... You don't have to say, I would have done this, but what do you think when you hear that? Put yourself in that situation.
Go ahead. No, I'm just saying this is a huge temptation.
Mm.
Yeah, because they've been being taught to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's hit where they have to choose, blend in or not.
Yeah. God's sort of forcing them into this, like, you got to choose this day whom you want to serve, in a sense. Yeah, definitely.
I think it's also hard to, I mean, you have to commit to die. I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah. But it's, and it's hard because you're looking at your neighbor, you know, people who you probably respected or were with, and then at some point it became shallower and shallower. Yeah. And, you know, it's die on the mountain or not.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's not an easy situation.
No.
The response is that sort of what you should do seems very easy and clear, and it is, but it's the reality of actually doing that is very difficult. Because the act itself doesn't seem particularly, I'll just do it, right? I won't mean it. I'll worship God while I bow. All these sort of ways, right, we might try to get out of it. Yeah, Jane.
Well, I can remember when my kids were little, and I'd run through these scenarios in my head. You know, somebody would come knock on our door and say, you know, we don't believe in, what's the word? Deny Christ.
Right.
And, you know, you can all live. And, man, because I think of my kids, you know, I can make a decision for myself, and I'm not sure what I would do with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for my kids, I'd want to protect them. That would be my goal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I
wouldn't mean it.
Right, but there's and that's a real thing. And it's interesting, is this is Daniel, right? And it's easy to be, oh, it's just Daniel. This is kind of a contrived situation. But this is a real thing that people have and do face, right? Somebody mentioned missionaries in the first class. Like,
but
missionaries face some of these things.
Today in HEB, I'm just saying, people will boldly say, you went to church. I mean, it's pretty blatant now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you can see the end times coming.
Yeah, and it's not like there's not like a furnace somewhere in Bernie that people are ready to throw you into, but
not that you know.
Pardon?
No.
Not that
you know. But there's to mock Christianity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there is definitely that sense.
Or even to be more tolerant and be more of a universalist, like.
Yeah.
You shouldn't criticize. I mean, yeah, that's good for you, but you shouldn't criticize because they're doing something different.
Yeah, there's
all of the faces.
There's an exclusivity here, isn't there? Right. This is the way. Yeah, and so it's really an interesting predicament that they're placed in. It's interesting. The early church wrestled with this, right? You had. Here's one example, Polycarp, right? That's kind of, he's an early martyr. He died when he was 86, and he had this chance. He was burned, so a bit of a parallel here. And at 86, he had the chance, the guy who was sort of going to execute him said, hey, you're really old. I don't want to go through with this, but you're not denying Christ. Could you just sort of like, kind of just do it so I don't have to be the guy who executed an 86-year-old? And I don't have it in my notes, but Polycarp's response basically is, no, served him faithfully, I've got to keep doing this, right? And all of us applaud and we say, yes, go Polycarp. I want to be a Polycarp. And that's good. We should want to do that. But in the generations following that, there were a lot of people that actually did recant Christianity. There were people that when faced with real persecution, 300 AD, there's some pretty significant persecution by Diocletian and other Roman empires. They really persecute the church. And so what did some people do? They did kind of what you said. They sort of crossed their fingers and recanted. You could even actually buy a certificate. This isn't what it was called. A certificate of recanting. So you could show people and say, hey, no, I recanted. Right? I was a Christian, but I've recanted. Here's my documentation. And that's really, it's sad. It's all those things. But the generation after that, what happened is the persecution was gone. Right? Constantine comes in. Christianity becomes the legal religion, all those sorts of things. And so now you have a problem. All these people want to come back to the church. What do you do? Do you let them in? Or do you say, no, you recanted, you can't come in? You let them in. And that's what the church did. They actually did bring them back in. There's a lot, it's a complicated history, but that's the shortened version. There were other things at play there. It's just an interesting dynamic, right, to think through. Denying the faith here, it's not like, I don't want to be careful how I say this, but just sort of saying, I don't believe this once isn't sort of like the unforgivable sin, right, so to speak. The unforgivable sin is just perpetual unbelief. And so Daniel does what's right here, but we need to kind of think through the complexities of this in our in our lives. There is a call to stand for the truth, to and to trust God for the results. This is what it's saying, but not forgetting grace, right? Grace is also a part of the picture.
Anybody, you know, past or present, could stand firm on their own strength.
Well, we need God's strength. The other thing that is interesting is these three have each other. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about what would happen if one of them broke ranks, right? Said, actually, you two, you have fun. I'm just going to go do this thing. And it would have been easier at that point to be like, okay, I guess it's not that bad. I guess I'll just cross my fingers and go and do this. I say this all because Daniel invites us to ask these questions, and it gives us an example, and it gives us a picture of God's care for us in the midst of this. That's what we need to see. We also see, even in these verses, I think a little bit of the king being mocked a little bit. It's easy for us to read this story, right? This is why this is a great Sunday school story, because God wins, there's no damage done, everybody's great at the end of the story. And Nebuchadnezzar is kind of poked fun at. It's like, he set it up. He set up this glorious image, those kind of things. And so in hindsight, Daniel writing this gives us some of those clues. Where is Daniel, by the way?
Well, I was going to say, yeah. I mean, the question was asked earlier, did everybody do it?
Yeah.
Well, where's Daniel in this?
Mm-hmm.
He's not there.
He's not there.
He's just writing the story.
And like, my response in the next part, whenever I read it, I'm like, they're sitting there going to the king. Their first thought is probably like, where's Daniel? Like, dude, where is he?
I wrote this a long time ago.
Where is Daniel? Yeah, and there are kind of two... guesses, I guess, at where he is. One is, and I don't think this is necessarily the best one, he's just out on a mission, right? Sometimes these people would be sent out to a province to check on a problem, so maybe he's out of town. That's one view. The other view is that Daniel is pretty high up in the echelon of the palace at this point, and so they just assume that he's trustworthy. He's so high up that he doesn't need to sort of prove his loyalty again, and so he's not included in these lists of people that they list because he's above them. He's so high up in the king's administration. That makes some sense, but again, that's not in the text. He is just not present in this moment. He'll face his own similar moment in the lion's den in a few weeks. All right, any other thoughts on these verses?
You know, I keep going back to chapter 2, verse 47.
Mm-hmm.
It just surprises me, which is so typical of the Bible, though, I think, that where it says, Nebuchadnezzar says, truly, your God is God of gods,
yeah,
and Lord of kings,
yeah,
and of revealer of mysteries, for you've been able to reveal this mystery. But he even says, truly, your God is God of God, Lord of kings.
Yeah.
Yet now he sets up that image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to see that that's a pattern that you're noticing there that repeats a couple times in the book of Daniel, where you're like, oh, he got it. He's saying the right thing. In fact, the person who says the most theologically correct things in the book of Daniel is usually King Nebuchadnezzar, right? Because he says something that you're like, that's the right answer. And what we saw last week, he asks a question, like, what God, I blank on where it is, but he basically says, or verse 11 of chapter 2, the thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, right? Like, that's, Nebuchadnezzar's like, tell me this. And then the answer of verse 47, God can do. And we're going to see the same kind of dynamic here, where he's going to say in just a moment, what God can save you. And then he's going to have a similar confession where he says, the true God, the most high God.
It's kind of like the truth is always there, but they choose to sideline it.
Yeah. It's like, it's true, but I'm just going to carry on with what I do. And that's a dynamic that Daniel wrestles with and kind of shows, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar next week is going to get humbled significantly because of his pride.
And I wonder how many people today see the truth in the Bible and the mm-hmm. gospel, but I don't know, for some reason they choose to push it to the side,
yeah,
so they can live their life, whatever
yeah.
that means.
Well, I know, I think that's exactly acknowledging the truth, and then we can talk about idolatry a little bit, but they sort of say, I'd rather cling to my idols. I'd rather cling to my security, my comfort, what I think will work, because obedience is costly. Right, and that's what these guys are going to find out. Obedience actually costs you something.
Using God,
mm-hmm.
I mean, using God to fill that purpose, but
yeah.
it's not really God.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Over your own desires.
For sure. All right, let's keep reading, because we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree, and every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. All right, so now we have these guys who come in and get in the way of the situation and sort of say, hey, we noticed something out there. They had their clipboards and they said these guys fell apart. And people debate, you know, the motivation here. Maybe they're just sort of, one person says obnoxious busybodies. We're like, ha, somebody's disobeying. Or maybe they were sort of jealous of these folks who had been elevated to very prestigious pieces or places in the realm of Babylon. And so they come and they sort of flatter the king a little bit and say, you might have made a mistake here. You appointed these guys, but you got a chance. You can just throw them in the fire now and we'll be done with them and it'll all be okay. And so what does the king do in this moment? Well, flipping over the page, or at least in my Bible, to verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, then when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And here's the question. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? All right. So Nebuchadnezzar, to his credit, is raging mad. And he could have just said, into the furnace with them. But instead, he says, all right, they're valuable guys in my administration. Come before me and explain yourselves. And he gives them a second chance, in a sense. You can bow down one more time. And you'll be fine. But remember, I'm the one who's in charge. No God can deliver you. And he asks this question. It's kind of interesting, where he says, to fall down and worship the image that I have made. And then the English translations put in well and good. That's not actually in there. It's almost like he sort of has this threatening pause in the Hebrew, which is hard to, you can't really write it that way. But you could insert threatening pause in your Bible. But the sense is, if you don't, then this will happen. You will be cast into the furnace. So now they couldn't sleep in. They couldn't sort of half bow the knee, whatever. Like, they're in the hot seat, frying pan into fire. They're in front of Nebuchadnezzar, and he's saying, are you going to do this? And he's saying, you must do this, or the consequence will be this, to be this way. And just think about what pressure does to us. Think about what pressure does to you. When you're pressured, whether it's, I mean, we use the term peer pressure, but just situations in life pressure you so profoundly, it would be really easy at this point to say, guys, we have a good gig here. In fact, we're actually doing some good. We're able to look out for the Jewish people. We can just sort of, I don't know, say it, not mean it, something like that. We can fudge our way through this. But they don't do that, do they? We're going to see the response in a minute. But that's hard for us to I think, get our minds and our hearts around, that these people know so profoundly the temptation of living in exile is to just sort of fit in. Isn't that true? Like, we're tempted to fit in. And Daniel, these men in the book of Daniel, God's people in the book of Daniel, are resisting that. Think all the way back to chapter 1. Right, what does Daniel not do? He doesn't eat the king's food, right? And there's a couple things going on there. Part of it is lots of that food would have been sacrificed to idols, but it's usually the vegetables that he decided to eat would have been sacrificed to idols too. So I think the best way to understand what's going on there is he knows the temptation of living in exile. What's your temptation? To fit in. And think about being a Jew, like suddenly you're in Babylon, the seat of power, and you're like, I can just kind of live here and feast. And so instead of being tempted by that delicious king's table food, he says, I'm going to eat vegetables because I know that it's dangerous to live in the temptation of Babylon because I just want to fit in. Because what happens to people when they move into a new culture? You fit in pretty quickly. I share this with the earlier class. So my dad is a first-generation immigrant from the Netherlands to Canada. He claims that because he was 3 months old when he moved. So technically a first-generation, or I guess he's an immigrant and I'm a first-generation immigrant, however you do that. So he was brand new. But think about, and you've seen this in other cultures, when people move, what do they do when they first get there? They kind of stay together, right? So in my parents' experience, they went to churches that were in Dutch, in homes that spoke Dutch. Both of them, when they went to kindergarten, especially my mom, didn't speak any English, right? So they were dropped off at an English kindergarten and said, figure it out. And they did, because they were with a bunch of other Dutch kids, and they're like, I don't know what's happening, we'll figure this out together. But gradually things change, right? I'm a product of that. So my upbringing was largely outside of that little Dutch bubble. And then when I married Virginia, this is funny, when she met my grandparents and some of my great aunts and uncles, the first time they came and saw her, we were in college dating, and they were going to Florida, and they stopped off, and we had dinner together. And we're sitting in a Cracker Barrel in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and they peppered Virginia for 30 minutes trying to find somebody in her family tree that was Dutch. And it was sweet. They're like the sweetest people. Like, there was no like animosity, but part of them were like, there's no Dutch in there, like none, like, you know, that kind of thing, right? And now I didn't tell the first classes, my brother is now dating seriously a Dutch girl who's got like the Dutch pedigree, and so that's, you know, what you're supposed to do. I say all of this, right, because that pressure to assimilate, or just the natural sort of like, it's just easy to fit in, right? And when you talk about a 400-year exile, you just start fitting in a little bit, and not just in the sort of marriage, those kind of things, but the whole, like, what's important, how does the world work? And that's what Daniel is so wisely aware of. He says, if I live here, and if I start eating the luxury of the king's table, it's going to become really easy then when somebody says, just bow the knee a little bit, I'm just going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing I just noticed too, though, in the same thought, is that at the beginning, it talks about just worshiping the image, but when the Chaldeans come and make their accusation, they say, these men do not serve your gods or worship.
Yeah.
And then when Nebuchadnezzar addresses them, he asks them, so are you not going to serve or worship? So there's that next step, that is slippery slope.
Yeah, it's not, it's an all-encompassing, like, are you part of us or are you not?
And it it's not a one-time event, like, okay, for this special occasion, I'll attend.
Yeah.
It's not just a one-time event.
Yeah.
This is going somewhere.
Yeah, and that becomes a theme. It kind of ratchets up through the book, right? And at least the narrative part in chapter 6, when it kind of wraps up, it's the same sort of thing. Are you going to pray? Like, who are you going to pray to, right? That same question. Jane, did you have something?
Oh.
Yeah.
No. Well,
okay, good. Yeah.
I think I've always thought in this story that music played over and over, and every time it played, they had to worship.
Yeah.
Is that the way it was, or was it just that one time?
Verses 1, it's a little unclear, but it does say whenever the worship or played back in verse earlier.
It says
that,
yeah.
What verse?
Let's see.
Number 3:5.
3:5, okay, yeah. Whenever you hear, yeah. So it seems to be that there might have been a few chances of it. There's definitely another, like, second chance later in the text, where, like, let's play it again, let's give you another go at it. So there is a definitely second chance. But yeah, it's there is a bit of a pattern, I think, this symbol.
You know, just have to remember, Satan's always behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's never going to be satisfied if we just give in, just do a little bit and go a little further. No, his goal is to worship evil.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so it's not he got you to do it this one time. He wants, to use a New Testament term, shipwreck your soul. That's what he wants to have happen. Yeah, and so just, I think there's, when we think about the whole, like, living in exiles thing, that's when it becomes a little bit more helpful to us to see this passage and say, like, where am I just sort of fitting in to the world? Where have I just sort of, in complacency or just not even realizing, worship the idols of my day, right? Where have I said, my money, my finances, my comfort, all those things are so primary that I just live like that's what matters. And I think I haven't really noticed this before looking at Daniel, but this time through, going back to that, like, I'm not going to eat the rich food. Like, that's convicting.
Yeah.
That gets me a little bit. And I'm like, I don't exactly know how to apply all of that to my life, but I also know that there's a part of me that is like, it's really easy to justify comfort being primary in my life. Not that comfort is terrible. It's not saying that. It's not saying anything like in that king's table like couldn't have been eaten, so to speak. But he knows that there's a spiritual dynamic to the world that we live in that sort of directs us a certain way. And we've got to be cognizant of that.
What is that verse? All things are
permissible, yeah,
but not
profitable. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that's a helpful way of reading this, right? Yeah. All right. So here's the king's question, right? Verse 15. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Now, verse 16 through 18, this response. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now, that is a response. Mm-hmm. We're like, go Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is awesome. Go for it, guys. That's a really bold response, isn't it? The first part there when it says we have no need to answer to you, it's I don't think they're being just sort of like flippant with the king. It's sort of, people debate it a little bit, but it might be sort of a Babylonian term for like some legal, like, we don't have standing here, we just got to do this, is sort of their point. But they sort of say, you know, our God is able to deliver us, but if he doesn't, we can't do what you ask. That's a response. Right, and all of us read that and say, that's what I want to do. And though we do have to ask the question honestly and say, would I? How well equipped am I to do that? I think one thing somebody noted earlier is the helpfulness of having the three of them do it together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we actually need each other in these moments. If one of them had sort of broken off and broke ranks, it would have been far easier for the other ones to join company, but they did this together. Picture of why we need the church. We need each other. But yeah, what do you guys think of this? What do you think of this response?
It's like the story of Trinity supports Voice of the Martyrs.
Yeah.
We get the magazine every month, and there are people that give the many stories about the spouses where the husband has, you know, said, nope, I won't give in, and then he's killed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're left.
Yeah.
And then they're still serving. It's
mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
They're.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's where Voice of the Martyrs and stuff like that is helpful, because it's really easy for this to seem so distant. It's not. Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is why you teach your kids to have Christian friends and look for those immediately in school, because there will be taunting.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to support, and not in the like fiery furnace way, but just that
mm-hmm.
it's easy to want to sort of go. And I think one other thing that's interesting and I find helpful here is they're committed to being faithful regardless of the consequence. That makes sense, right? They're committed to saying, this is what is right. It might not work, right? We shouldn't read this story and say, if you just had a little bit more faith, then God would send the fourth person into the fire of your life and take you out. That's a bad reading of Daniel 3.
Yeah, because they're basically saying they don't need the answer, because it's what God decides is what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's kind of hang the consequences, I'm going to do what I need to do. I think what's also helpful is it reminds us that even if we're faithful, it doesn't mean we're going to change the course of history. I've been doing a lot of reading on Dietrich Bonhoeffer leading up to World War II and sort of what people were preaching and those sort of things in that moment. And there's this guy named Paul Schneider, who was a part of the Confessing Church, those who sort of stood against Hitler. And he said this, he wrote a letter to his wife from a concentration camp. And he said in the in a letter, it's not that we didn't say too much, it's that we didn't say enough. So he wished that he had said more. But what's really interesting is you read that, and I think he's right in some sense. People could have said more against Hitler leading up to all those atrocities. That's true. But people were saying stuff. And that's what I found in sort of my research. Tons of people were taking bold stances and saying this is the wrong way to go. So much so that actually, and this is interesting, I'm going off memory here, but in the elections right before Hitler sort of took power, the Nazi Party only got about 20% of the vote, which is helpful for us to remember, right? Because people did say stuff. People did say, this is not the direction we want to go. But evil had a way of winning the day anyways. And this is a helpful correction, I think, to us sometimes, because we're like, man, if we just did this the right way, then all would go well in our lives. All would go well in the world. And sometimes you do everything right. Sometimes you say the right things, you preach the right things, and God in his sovereignty is doing something bigger. And I'm not pretending to attribute atrocities to God or anything like that. It's just, it's a little bit more complicated than sometimes we think it is. And that's where Daniel, this response is helpful, because it acknowledges that sometimes things are complex, but then there's also just like, I can't do that, right? At this moment, I gotta be faithful, hang the consequences. So what happens? Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression on his face was changed, right? He was furious rage. Now he's even more angry, it seems. He's angry against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent, and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. All right, it happened. Their worst fear, so to speak, was confirmed, and we can imagine some of the moments here where they're going towards the fire, they feel the heat, and that would have been another chance to go say, wait, I'll do it. But they don't, and this king's rage is intense. He heats it 7 times hotter. again, people debate. What this fiery furnace is probably like a kiln, sort of like a dome kind of thing, where they have the fire, and it's possible they used it and sort of wasn't just built for this, but it would have been part of their industrial sort of making of bricks and other things for even this statue that they see. And just to give you a range, people have looked at these types of things in archaeology. They can get like 900 to 1100 degrees Celsius. That's like really hot. That's their normal operating temperature. And they can get up to like 1500 degrees. And so it's...
I just wonder what they look like, because they saw into it to see them dancing.
Yeah.
So
people debate, so kind of like almost like a silicone kind of cylinder, right? And it sort of had like a door. It uses the word door. But even just like the ventilation kind of thing. And so then the king later looks into it. So it seems weird for there to be like a window in it, but maybe he saw through a ventilation hole. I don't know.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot to go on. But anyways, it gets really hot.
Yeah.
They put more coal, they stoke the bellows. It gets up to 1500 degrees. So that 7 times is more of a like perfection. It's as hot as it can get, that sort of thing. So much so that these mighty men are just sort of engulfed in the flames, right? Because they have to carry these 3 men into the fire and kind of set them there and then leave, and it's too hot, they're overcome. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. They're there, they're in the fire. One way to understand what's going on here, just before we get into all the details, is God often saves us not from trial, but through trial, right? God could have just sort of changed Nebuchadnezzar's mind, right? He could have said, oh, you said something really bold in verse 17 there, you're good, just Nebuchadnezzar's going to change his mind now. But no, he actually brings him into the trial, into the intensity of the heat. We can overread that and make it all about us, but there is a pattern in how God works here that I think we need to see that God often brings people into difficulty. Psalm 23, right? Walk through the valley of the shadow of death, yet he is with me, right? That's the picture. God is with his people in these moments. All right, so you're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What are you thinking at this moment? What are you thinking? You're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Nothing.
Nothing. You're like, oh man, it's over, right?
I'd be amazed at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why am I not burning? Yeah. Like, yeah. So as you fall in, you would have been like, and it's like, did they feel some heat? Did they, you know, we've got questions, right? I'm sure their kids asked them, like, tell me exactly how that went down. Like, what did it feel like?
Are we in heaven yet?
Are we in heaven yet? Yeah, like, is this what it feels like to die? Who knows? But they would feel all of these, have all of these questions. And then what happens? Verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 bound men into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th man is like the son of a god. All right. So they're delivered. This is the good part of the story. God in his grace, his sovereignty, decides he's going to rescue these people, and he does it. King Nebuchadnezzar has been watching this execution, I guess you could say, and he asks the question, wait, didn't we just throw 3 in? I'm a little confused. And he gets validation, it was just 3, and there are 4 men unbound walking in the fire. So who's the 4th man? There's Jesus is one answer, and Jesus, so we got a Jesus camp. The other answer that people come up with is an angel. Right, Nebuchadnezzar in verse 28 is going to say that this is an angel. He sent an angel. And so, honestly, it's a point that doesn't deeply matter for the story. The early church were the first ones to look at this and say, hey, it's a 4th man, son of man, those kind of things. It's Jesus. That's more of a theological argument, right? Because we know that God comes near to us with his presence. And so where does he do that most clearly? In Jesus, in the incarnation, he comes near to us. And so it makes some sense, although in the text directly, there's nothing that makes it have to be Jesus. It could just be an angel. The big point, though, is what does God do with his people when they're in trial? Comes near to them, right? I think that's the most helpful way to take it. God could have just spoken, right? He could have just changed Nebuchadnezzar's mind again or something like that. But God chose to come near through his angel or through Christ to this man, or in the person of this man, to help these 3 men.
It seems like he came near even before they were thrown into the furnace. Mm-hmm. If the guards were there,
couldn't make it that close. Yeah, he's already caring for them. Yeah, yeah. And we'll see that in a moment when they're like, they don't smell like smoke. It's like, that means he's right from the get-go as they're approaching the furnace. He knows, and he has his plan. And so this is, it's a beautiful moment, right, where they are saved. There's this rejoicing, right, this surprising redemption as they are taken out of this picture. And for God's people reading this story, this would have been deeply encouraging, as it can be for us. A few places in Scripture that talk about some of these things. Deuteronomy 4:20 talks about, it compares Egypt and the exile in Egypt as being saved through the iron furnace. And that reference occurs a couple other times in the Old Testament. Through the iron furnace, this picture of sort of being in fiery trial and God drawing them out. And also, maybe more familiarly, Isaiah 43, verses 1 and 2 says this, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. That's Isaiah written before Daniel, so it's likely that they may have known those words as they approach this moment. The point being that God is near to these people, and we can extrapolate that and say God is near to us in our trials. God is near to us in our moments of temptation, our moments of fear. All of these things, God is near to us. It might not look as dramatic as here. We'd like it all to look this way, but God is nonetheless near to his people. And that's what this astonishment on Nebuchadnezzar's part is pointing us to, that he sees what is true and is amazed. Let's see his response in verse 26, where he says this, then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw the fire had not any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. And think for a moment back to verse 26 there. Nebuchadnezzar gets it right. What does he say? The Most High God, right? He's acknowledging that this is the real God, the Most High God. And he'll say even verse 28, he says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." Like, that's, again, Nebuchadnezzar is just like saying good, crystal clear biblical truth. And he doesn't quite get it. We even know by him saying Most High God, he's not sort of denouncing his other gods. He's not converting, but he is saying here is real power that even a pagan king recognizes. And that's really the beauty for us, right? When he asked the question back in verse 15, who is the God who would deliver you out of my hands? Well, the Most High God. And he answers his own question here. And so for us, when we ask that same question, who's going to deliver us? It's the Most High God, the one who is powerful enough to even do this not singed thing, right? We picture these guys usually coming out and they're kind of like a little disheveled, kind of singed hair, right? Smelling really bad. Like, there's nothing. And you know how easily smoke clings to something. It's dissipated a little bit, or I've just got used to it. I walked in here this morning and the building smelled like brisket. And I was like, this smells really good. And then I talked to somebody else. They were doing somebody was burning some brush, and that had wafted in kind of to the building yesterday. But this morning it still smelled. I don't know if you smelled it when I walked in. I was like, this smells like some good smoked meat. Unfortunately there was none of that. But it clings so easily, right? You know, by a campfire and you like reek like smoke for, you know, until you wash your clothes three times. That's the, you know, that's a subtle thing, but that's the power of God, totally protecting these people. Unsinged. I don't know if you ever singed your hair by campfire. I've been dumb a couple times and can tell you stories, but it like smells really bad. And it's like, yeah, none of that. And this is a crazy hot fire that engulfed other people. It's just a detail in the text that I think causes us to, again, be amazed that God is completely in control of this situation. The Chaldeans, all the people, they say that the fire had no power over the bodies of these men, right? Why? Because God is the one who is powerful. And so we can take great hope, great confidence that God is a God who has this power. And what's the king's final decree? Verse 29, "Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruin. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the provinces of Babylon. So here, God is again elevating these people who, you know, remember the Chaldeans were trying to like maliciously bring them down. God brings them back up into positions of even greater power than they had before. And that makes sense, verse 30. But what about this thing in verse 29? The king makes this decree. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? I remember this morning. Growing up, we had a cassette tape of Old Testament stories, and I'm pretty sure this was on side B of the cassette, and it had this very dramatic reading of this story. And I remember being like middle school, I don't know, 10, 11 or something, listening to this and being like, this is awesome. Verse 29, like it's not quite, but it's like enforced conversion. That's not really what happens, but that was my view as like a 10-year-old. I was excited, right? God's people are like in power now. And if you say anything bad about God, we're going to rip you limb from limb and take your house down. Right? And you're like, wait a second. But there's a part of us that is that 10-year-old boy that says, yay, I want that. But we also know that that rock, that kingdom, right, that comes back in chapter 2 that knocks down the kingdom is a totally different kingdom. It's not a kingdom that comes and does this, right? It's the kingdom of Christ that comes in with a radically different view of power, a view of service, of a king who dies, who comes near to his people. And so even as there is some protection offered to God's people here, this is ultimately not what makes the church thrive, right? When the church has power like this, it usually doesn't do well with it, right? We saw that when Rome came in, right? Made it the original, like the formal, the religion of the realm, and it didn't make the church grow in the ways that it needs to grow. The church often grows when it's small, when it's under pressure, when it's suffering. That's when the church flourishes. And so it's interesting. And even this decree, it doesn't look like it was followed completely, as we'll see in the chapters coming from this. But why I'm saying that is we can read this and we can long for something like that, where we could have control, security, and power in a king like Nebuchadnezzar. Because we read that and we're like, good, Nebuchadnezzar can do what he wants, right? He can make everybody safe. But who ultimately makes us safe? The God who doesn't even let his people get singed by fire. And so we need to hear that, because that's part, again, of sort of living in the world that we do. Our view of power is such that if we just could have power, things would go well. Then we'd be safe. Then we'd be comfortable. If we could have earthly power, if we could have a king who is on our side, then things would go well. But the point of the story is that the kings of the earth, right, back in chapter 1, are changed like the seasons, because God is in control. And we need God and his power. That's the only way that we're safe. That's the only hope they will ultimately have. Other thoughts on Daniel 3?
It's kind of like executive orders, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? Says, okay, we're going to do it this way.
Yeah.
Comes in, nope. Scratch that.
Scratch that. I'm going to write it down and do it differently. Yeah, and it's a reminder of how fickle those things are. Like, and that's part of the, I think even part of this book, there's a little bit of mocking of the king's decrees, right? Because he makes a decree, day later, I got a new decree. And it's like, well, king's decrees, just, they don't matter ultimately. It's God who matters. And we say that, it's really easy to say that flippantly and be like, yeah, God's in charge. It's really hard to live that way, because the king's decrees do impact us. They do make a difference in our daily lives. But ultimately, we know that God is in control. And that's where this book again and again sets our hearts on the fact that we have a true king. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Would you cause this to, a passage like this, rattle around in our minds a little bit, to confront our idolatry, to confront our sin, but really, Lord, ultimately to point us to the hope we have in you. Would you help us to know in a deep, meaningful way that you truly are our King? Would that make a difference in how we live, how we think, how we love? We pray this in your name. Amen.
Thank you.